Welcome to This Is Money podcast, brought to you in partnership with Charles Stanley Direct, the award-winning investment platform trusted by over 40,000 clients. Investment involves risk. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And are negative interest rates off the table? The Bank of England says rate cuts are now less effective than QE stimulus as the UK's economic outlook brightens. So with that in mind, have we all been a bit too gloomy about the financial situation of the nation as a result of coronavirus? Ian Duncan Smith is warning of economic Armageddon, but the property market is bouncing back as we all want to move to the country, car sales are up, and we're all dining out on the cheap thanks to the government. Plus, we look at gold, it's soaring, but will it last? And the best electric cars you can buy, whatever your budget. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news, just go to thisismoney.co.uk. or download the app. But first, the Bank of England is discussing negative interest rates as a measure to deal with the financial fallout from coronavirus. But will they really go there? There were four pages in its most recent monetary policy report dedicated to outlining the pros and cons of such a move for households, banks, and for the broader economy. Now, uncertainty is, as the bank admits, the name of the game for now. And it seems to be keeping its options open in terms of the future of monetary policy. But it did say, though, in amongst all of that, that negative interest rates could be less effective than other stimulus measures. So firstly, welcome, Simon. Why would the Bank of England be thinking about negative interest rates anyway? What good would it do? It said it's looking at households, it's looking at banks and the broader economy. So with all of those in mind, what would be the point?
I suppose before we get on to the negatives of negative interest rates, we should talk maybe about the positives, about why this idea even exists in the first place. Essentially, the principle is that what the Bank of England would want to do is encourage banks to lend out money rather than hoard cash, and to encourage people to borrow that money rather than hoard cash. In times of recession, you tend to have a shrinking in people's desire to borrow money. And the way that money is created within the banking system is effectively people borrowing money. And so when you go to the bank and you take out your mortgage, the bank doesn't go down to its vaults, get a couple of hundred thousand pounds out that it's got sitting there, and then lend it to you. It doesn't even digitally transfer some money that it's got sitting there from savers. It has a person, I presume it's a person, maybe it's a computer program, someone somewhere has to hit a keyboard key, I'm sure. And when they hit that key, the money is created. £200,000 into your bank, an extra £200,000 is created in the economy. And the more money that is being borrowed, the more that the money supply is increasing, the greater the rate of inflation. And it's considered to stimulate growth because people take that money and then they do stuff with it. It's very unlikely that you would take that money and then go stash it under your bed and do nothing with it. So, for example, that when people borrow some money to buy a house, somebody else sells that house to them, but they also go off and they spend money, buying things for the house, doing work on the house, all those other things. It creates a multiplier effect. Likewise, if a business borrows money, then it goes and puts that money to productive use. Not always, sometimes it just burns through the cash. But even burning through the cash means it's giving the money to someone, unless it's literally doing a KLF and burning the cash. But the idea behind shifting interest rates around is that by controlling the price of the money, you can increase the demand for it, or you can decrease the demand for it. So, for example, if you take interest rates down from 5% to 4%, borrowing money all of a sudden becomes much more attractive to people because their mortgage payments would be lower, it will cost them less over the long term. Perhaps that business decision that they were going to make now makes sense. If you take rates down from 1% to 0.5%, though, you start to find that there isn't that much difference because at 1%, I mean, money's pretty cheap. And if we look back all the way to the end of the financial crisis, money has been pretty cheap since then. And arguably, the main issue since the financial crisis, once we got over the initial mortgage crunch that came where loans were pulled for small deposit mortgage borrowers and there was effectively a credit crunch that's what caused the financial crisis. Once we got through that and the money started being pumped into the system by central banks, by the time interest rates were cut to what was then a record low of 0.5%, we reached a situation where possibly the problem was not that money was not cheap enough, that wasn't the issue with stimulating demand. Possibly the problem was that people were just cautious. They were worried. They didn't want to borrow the money. And we've had this problem after the financial crisis with business investment. So the Bank of England and analysts and all the other pointy heads out there have been scratching their pointy heads and wondering why businesses are not taking that cheap money they can get their hands on and using it for productive purposes, spending on improving their business, spending on improving the tools that their workers have to use, be they office workers or, you know, manufacturing workers or whatever. And this started to pick up a bit. I think 2020 was going to be the year of recovery. I mean, barring the endless arguments about Brexit that has hampered the economy over the past few years, we had political certainty. We had actually technically Brexited, although not technically Brexited until the end of the year. And so it was going to be the year everything picked up. And then we've had the coronavirus crash. We've had lockdown. We've had the biggest hit to the economy. It was going to be since the 17th century, but it's now only for a century, so it's not as bad as it was. And the Bank of England slashed interest rates again, and we've got them down to 0.1%. So where do you go from there? Well, 0% is the obvious answer, but shaving a tenth of a percentage point of interest rates isn't going to make much difference. What about if you go negative? Well, if you go negative, then what happens that instead of banks earning just a teeny tiny tiny amount of interest on money that they have parked short term with the Bank of England, they end up paying the Bank of England to park that money there. Now, if you're a bank and you're holding on to money because you think that bad times are ahead and people are going to be defaulting on their loans and job losses are going to rise when the furlough scheme ends and they're already rising anyway and actually things don't look that great and the effects of this might last some time, you might want to try and hold on to your cash. But the paradox of thrift applies to banks as well as it does to people in times of recession, although it might actually probably be the most sensible course of action for the banks to hold on to their cash. You want the banks not to be doing that. You want the banks to be expanding their balance sheets, to be lending out money that they've created. And likewise with savers, you want savers to be doing the same thing. You don't want people to be accumulating money in their savings accounts and sitting there thinking, I need a bigger rainy day pot. You want people to be running down their rainy day pot, not too much, but because obviously then they're exposed. But, you know, the weirdness of crisis economics is that you want people to be out there spending. Hence, Rishi's meal deals, eat out to help out, Monday to Wednesday, 50% off. On the taxpayer, hence, you know, the furlough scheme, trying to keep people in jobs, but also trying to keep people in money so that they can continue to pay their bills and also do some spending. And hence, you know, even things like quantitative easing, the funding for lending style schemes that pump money to the banks and so on. So if you go negative, then that means the banks lose money by holding on to cash. But also if the banks then pass on the negative rates to their savers, that means that that money you've got sat in a savings account is no longer earning interest. It's no longer earning a pitiful amount of interest, as many savings accounts are paying at the moment. It's actually costing you money, the money that you've got sat there in your bank account. Now, that's the sort of theory and positives, I guess, behind negative interest rates. And then there are the negatives.
Well, the negatives also come in comparison with other stimulus measures. That's what they're saying. And obviously they have negative issues in and of themselves. But what the Bank of England was saying, actually, in terms of effectiveness, there are other things that they can do which would have more effect. But my instinctive question would be, is there really anything that they can do? Haven't we been arguing for quite some time that there's not really a lot that central banks can do at the moment that they've not already done in the wake of the financial crisis. And you'd imagine we would have been back and they would have had more armor with which to deal with situations like this. But we haven't. 12 years on, we haven't got that armor, have we?
No. And arguably, you could say that we wasted a bit of time. Do you remember the old George Osborne, how he was going to fix the roof while the sun was shining stuff?
Yep.
I mean, there's a sizable number of people in this country who would debate whether he fixed the roof or whether he jumped up and down on the roof and broke it. But
how is the roof looking, though, in your
opinion? The roof's looking patchy.
Okay.
The roof looked better. To be fair, in terms of, if we're going to talk about banks, if banks are our metaphorical roof, the roof looks an awful lot better than it did after the financial crisis. And that is one of the things Andrew Bailey was talking about yesterday, the governor of Bank of England, with these negative rates, is that banks have rebuilt their balance sheets. When we went into the financial crisis, the big problem was banks had massively overexpanded. They were running very, very low capital ratios, which is essentially their safety buffer. And they had been just going completely bananas with a cheap credit boom through the early 2000s. Now, what we've seen this time around is that banks have been much more cautious, as you would expect any business that has had an existential crisis to be. Mm-hmm. And banks have largely gone into the coronavirus crisis looking pretty decent. Some of that is regulatory. So things have been tightened up. They have to hold more money, more capital against the size of their balance sheet. So against the amount of the loans that they make out, they've got to hold a certain amount of money. They have expanded less. They've chucked money around a bit less. They just, you know, long gone are the days when you used to go to the bank for a mortgage and the bank would say to you, well, you know, if you went interest only, you could borrow more money, as actually genuinely happened to people. Or, yeah, I'm sure that sort of like slightly dodgy income that you have will continue. In fact, it'll probably go up and that house will go up in value. And in fact, you could just resell it, you know, if you can't pay the mortgage. Here, have some money. All that kind of stuff was going on in the early 2000s, even in kind of some of the mainstream lending, let alone the stuff at the margins, which was completely bonkers, particularly in the US. But the banks haven't been doing that. They have been more cautious. Mortgages have been super cheap, but that's a product of the fact that interest rates have been very low and banks have been able to access very, very cheap money from the Bank of England, originally in the form of the Funding for Lending scheme. So the roof, in that sense, is looking pretty decent. The roof in sense of interest rates, though, and the base rate, looked decidedly patchy, because ideally what you wanted to do was go into the next crisis with interest rates having got back up off the floor and with a decent margin for cutting them. In the US, the Fed had done that. And it was able to cut by a reasonably sizable amount. They were nowhere near where they were historically, but it was able to cut by a sizable amount. In the UK, we've made it to 0.75%. The problem was we had Brexit. We had the crisis of confidence after Brexit. We had a rate cut after Brexit, which took us, you know, down below where we were. And then we managed to claw our way back up a bit. This was the year when maybe rates were going to go up, although there was already some question about that, because then we would have been moving in the opposite direction potentially to the Fed, and the recovery was starting to slow. But people thought that this was the year they could have gone up. But really, I think we would have wanted to go into this crisis at like 1.5-2% at least, because that would have given us a bit more wiggle room. Would it have made any difference? Who knows? But it would be nice to go in there with that, you know, available, and we didn't. And that was always my argument for trying to get rates up, that we needed to do it because there was going to be another recession. There was going to be another crisis. And we had a long time between the two of them, really. I mean, the financial crisis, the after effects of it lasted for a very long time, but you've got to expect something to roll around. What everybody didn't expect was a global pandemic. That was a proper black swan moment. So we haven't really got anywhere to go. The problem with negative rates, as I was saying earlier, is that there's a serious amount of debate as to how well they actually work and whether they do any good or whether they do more harm than good. So they're not very good for banks, because they cost banks money. You want your bank's balance sheets to be good. And this is one of the things that Andrew Bailey said yesterday. You know, he said, the UK financial system is sound. Or the Bank of England said this. The UK financial system is sound and banks' capital ratios have increased markedly over the past decade. Nonetheless, risks to banks' balance sheets are likely to be rising at the moment. The impact of COVID-19 on the economy will result in losses for lenders as some businesses fail and some households lose their jobs. As a result, implementing negative policy rates might be less effective in providing stimulus to the economy at the current juncture than at a time when banks' balance sheets are improving. At present, banks' balance sheets will be negatively affected by the period of severe economic disruption arising from COVID-19, and they have an important role to play in helping the UK economy recover by providing finance for individuals and companies. As a result, negative policy rates at this time could be less effective as a tool to stimulate the economy. That said, the wider economy and banks' balance sheets would be boosted by stimulus. The net effect of negative policy rates depends on these, among other factors. Translated, that says, actually, we think that negative rates might harm the banks. And if we're harming the banks' balance sheets, the banks will actually get more cautious and less likely to lend money. One of the problems we've got at the moment is that we've got very, very low interest rates. We've got the stamp duty holiday. We've got the housing market recovering better than expected. And we've got first-time buyers being shut out because they can't get small deposit mortgages. But it also sends out a message as well. You know, people, they register this stuff. They might not be as interest rate geeky as we are, but they register this stuff. Oh, someone told me interest rates have gone negative. That's really bad, isn't it? They don't see it. You don't get told that and go, oh, well, that's really good because that's going to stimulate the economy. You're like, that's really bad. If I've heard this thing's really bad, I'm going to hold on to my money and I'm maybe not going to spend it. And there's also the scenario where we've got a big division in this country between the people who've got lots of savings and the people who don't have much savings. And the people who've got lots of savings are very loath to spend them. And I think one of the issues with that is the very low rate that they are getting on their savings makes them more likely to actually save more money because they're like, well, I'm not going to get a boost from the interest, so I'm going to try and save more anyway.
Is there an argument then in sum to this that actually it might be better if the Bank of England just didn't really do anything?
Well, just sort of chilled out, like in the Mark Carney.
They can carry on with writing their reports, you know, because they like doing that sort of thing, don't they? But really...
Yes. Well, just, I mean, Mark Carney, the Maradona
Charles
swerve.
Is doing all right.
Where he says he's going to do things and then he just walks straight down the middle. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, they have done other stuff. They have pumped a load of money in, more quantitative easing, not this time around, but that they did do after the crash. And they've obviously cut rates substantially. But really, at the moment, actually, what they are doing is just trying to be a reassuring hand on the tiller. And effectively, they are not doing anything new. I personally, probably anybody listening would have gathered this from what I just said, but I have my doubts about negative rates. I really don't think that they work. I'm in the anti-negative rates camp. In terms of quantitative easing, they could do some more of that. There is concerns over the size of the sort of the rise in the money supply and the way that some of this money that the government stimulus is, instead of going to the financial system and then potentially trickling down, it's going directly to people, and that ultimately this will be inflationary. But the Bank of England isn't worried about inflation at the moment. The Bank of England is worried about the worst economic crash for a century, which is only going to be 9.5%. And not the 14.4% that was originally said. So, you know, only really bad, not really, 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 really bad. Although this might amuse you. I misheard it on the radio first thing yesterday morning when they said it revised their forecast, and I didn't hear the 9. I heard that they'd revised it to a fall of 0.5% from 14%. Ooh. I was like, what? No.
That would have been impressive.
Yeah. And then I heard 9.5. I was like, right, that makes considerably more sense.
Yes, doesn't it? I want to ask you about gold, if that's all right, because we saw gold prices soar to record highs this week, breaking through the $2,000 an ounce mark for the first time ever. Now, this is obviously, as coronavirus continues to wreak some havoc, shall we say, in the stock market, investors looking for a safe haven for their money. So gold has rallied now 35% since the start of 2020. So, Simon, what is so special about gold? Apart from it looks lovely.
It is a long-term store of value. If you went back 2,000 years and you had some gold, you could spend you could get some stuff for your gold, just like you could get some stuff for your gold now. And there is an argument that your gold would have been able to buy pretty much the same amount of stuff back then as it can now. It's a kind of, it's a hedge against inflation. I mean, good luck actually spending some gold. I mean, if you need a loaf of bread and a pint of milk, good luck to you if you do walk into the shop and there's a sign that says card payments only. And you say, well, I haven't got a card, but I do have some gold. But, you know, that's to be flippant. What you see is in times of crisis, people are attractive to it. It's seen as a safe haven. But for a safe haven, the price of gold doesn't half fluctuate. You need to, if you want to look at it as a long-term store of value, you need to look at it over the long term, and you need to ignore the bits where it goes up massively and then the price of it falls substantially. So the most recent sort of gold boom that we had was in the days after the financial crisis, when it went knocking on the door of 2000, but never quite got there. And then it fell. And then from about 2018, it started to rise steadily again. And then this year, with the coronavirus crash, it has gone up substantially. It's rallied by 35% since the start of 2020. Not as much as Tesla shares, but maybe gold is a longer term store of value than Tesla shares. I mean, Elon would probably tell you different, but there's two things going on here. Fear and crisis and people flocking to any safe haven that they can find. The other main safe havens that you get are, you know, top grade government bonds. But some of those top grade government bonds belong to what don't look like top grade governments, i.e. the US, the UK, and some of the major European countries, and Germany, for example. And there's concerns about, you know, effectively these countries are involved in printing money, in kind of cheapening the value of those bonds that you'd be buying. Whereas gold, on the other hand, as I said, is that long-term store of value. You know, Asterix and Obelix could have spent it and you could spend it today. The other thing that's going on is fear of inflation, fear of future inflation. There's this idea, not necessarily on the fringes, but, you know, there is an idea amongst a chunk of people, as I alluded to earlier, that the end game of what's going on at the moment with all the money that is being chucked at the wall to deal with the coronavirus crisis is that ultimately when you're throwing it against lockdown, it's sort of, some of the central banks are judging it to be safe because of the deflationary effects of the lockdown and pausing the economy. But this money is going directly into the economy. It's going directly into people's pockets, bank accounts, whatever you want to say, and that it will be inflationary, and that not for a couple of years inflation will fall, but then inflation will come back strong, and we could see, you know, back to 5% plus, even 10% inflation. We had an article, and we discussed this in a podcast a couple of months back, from a guy called Pete Comley, who's an inflation expert, and he's one of these people who suggests that there's going to be this inflationary wave come the end of the decade. And some people who are buying gold are buying into it, you know, off the back of that, because they think that they need something to protect them from that. And gold is the best way to do it. One interesting thing is that a lot of people are buying gold, not directly. They're not actually going out and buying gold coins, gold bullion. You have issues with storage. It's not that easy to do if you only want to buy a small amount. I mean, you'll need $2,000 for an ounce. So it's quite difficult to buy a relatively small amount of it. They're buying ETFs, exchange traded funds, which are passive funds traded on the stock market. And some of these will be derivatives. So they just kind of track the price of gold. But a lot of them hold physical gold. So as people buy more of the ETF, the ETF provider has to go out and buy more gold and store more gold. And some of these ETF providers are basically having to hoover up vast quantities of gold to meet the demand for the money that is flowing into the ETFs. Should be fine, should be safe. But when you see things like that, you start to think about, you know, potential points of stress in the financial system.
Indeed, Simon. But just in sum to this one, because I did ask at the start, will this continue? I guess it will, because it stops and starts and it has been forever thus, it will continue for as long as people don't feel confident investing in other areas And that's when we'll see it, perhaps the price fall a little bit, but it will continue as long as people feel insecure, I guess.
Yeah. And so this is the interesting thing with gold, is it is a safe haven, but it is also an entirely sentiment driven investment. And so you get momentum going on, you get people buying because other people are buying. How much of the rise in the gold prices is down to the same FOMO rally stuff, fear of missing out, that's driving the big US tech companies and the Teslas of this world to higher and higher heights? And the idea that, well, I'll buy it because there'll always be someone else who wants to buy it off me for a higher price. The good thing you have with gold versus Tesla, Bitcoin, you know, any other very high profile, very swift rising investment, is that long-term store of value. But people have got caught out by this. I remember last time around when the gold price went rocketing up, having a conversation with my dad about it. And I said to him, have you ever bought any gold? And he said, yeah, I did. I bought it when it was going up loads in the 80s. And then I lost loads of money on it. He said, I think it's still worth less than I paid for it then. I'm not sure whether that was actually the case. But, you know, so that he had to wait a couple of decades before the gold that he'd bought was worth what he paid for it. And I think he'd actually sold it by that point. So, you can't talk about gold without mentioning Gordon Brown either. That's the golden rule of This Is Money. If you write an article, there'll always be a reader in the comments underneath mentioning about how Gordon Brown sold our gold at the bottom. So there you go. Job done for anybody listening.
Phew, we got that in. Amazing. And it's always worth talking about the Chancellor George Osborne. Yeah. He gets in for lots of reasons. Normally it's ISIS, but we like to throw him in.
But another thing we should mention is that one of these ETFs, the SPDR Gold Shares ETF that buys physical bullion, has bought so much gold that the size of the fund's holdings, which are held in HSBC's London vaults, has climbed to 1,258 tons. This was earlier this week. And on Monday and Tuesday alone, it added another 15 tons, which is about five times as much as Michael Caine and the boys stole in the Italian job.
That's a great little stat you've got there, Simon. Fantastic. Right, we're going to talking about movies. I always look on the bright side of life, Simon. Always. When you sent over the suggestions today, you said, oh yeah, are we being a bit too negative? And so we thought, you looked at a few things and, you know, maybe you had a point there. You know, perhaps we are being a little bit too gloomy. Stamp duty has been cut. Property market looks to be bouncing back. People moving to the country for the good life. Plus new car sales are up. Probably not that hard given the context, but we have money off at Nando's as well. I don't, because I'm still in Spain and they're not offered. I've never seen a Nando's in Spain, to be honest. But there are other eateries in which I'm sure Rishi Sunak's Eat Out to help out. Discounts work as well, by the way. Caveat. But Simon, are we being a little bit just too negative? I say that now, just before we're about to talk about economic Armageddon with job losses. However, let's get the good stuff in now.
Yeah, so a V-shaped recovery argument, I guess. Are we going to bounce back? I think things in many ways have actually bounced back stronger than people expected. Now, there is obviously, when you shut down stuff completely, there will be some pent-up demand. But that pent-up demand could be severely eroded by a hopefully once-in-a-lifetime event, such as the complete freeze of lockdown. And so people could have come out of it going, I am definitely not going to be spending much money. I am going to be saving as much as I can. I am not going to be spending it on big ticket purchases. I am definitely not moving house because the housing market is going to absolutely tank and house prices are going to fall and I'll wait till they're cheaper. I am definitely not buying a new car because my existing car still works fine and I just don't need to spend that money. And I am definitely not going out to lunch or dinner because I need to keep that money safe in my pocket instead. Those are three, you know, little bits of economic activity. But the complete opposite has happened. The housing market has come back stronger than expected. One of the reasons why people didn't think that Rishi Sunak would cut stamp duty was because the housing market had already come back stronger than expected. There are going to be lots of people for whom that is not a possible that it's not possible for them to join in on that because they're either on furlough, they've lost their job, or they are going to struggle to get a mortgage due to the crunch for low deposit mortgages. But there are lots of people who have responded to the easing of lockdown by saying, well, you know what, let's try and move.
And well, those people who had already planned, like first-time buyers, and also we can't forget the people who want to divorce, maybe.
Yeah, but even if you take those people out, there are people who are like, no, do you know what, let's do it. That is a positive sign. Now, for all the concerns over, well, will this drive up house prices? Will the stamp duty cut just end up pushing up prices? Will people buy now and then end up actually with a home that's worth a bit less in a year's time or 2 years' time, whatever? You've got to remember that for every single, well, for nearly every single one of those people, for a lot of them, because some of them won't actually be moving somewhere they want to move to, they're going to be quite happy because they moved into a new house. There is a personal happiness thing that comes from it. Yeah, we managed to move. We moved into that new house. We got an extra bedroom. We got a bigger garden. We got a house that's more suited to us. We moved area and things like that. And puts a swing in people's steps. And they also go out and spend money on washing machines and sofas and wardrobes and all those other things. It does stimulate the economy. The new car thing, the new car sales in July last month were up 11.3% year on year. That was a big surprise because the news coming out of the car market has been universally awful for ages, dating back to before coronavirus. Now, one of the reasons for that is because there was a big peak in car sales before that. And what usually happens is when you get a peak, you get a trough that follows it. Now, some of these people are maybe just people coming to the end of their three-year PCP deals and they're just getting another car. But the fact that people are going out there and saying, yeah, do you know what? I will get a new car is a positive sign for the economy. It shows better than expected sentiment. Rishi's Meals, eat out to help out. 50% off your bill, Monday to Wednesday, up to £10 per person. Bit of a gimmick, bit of a budget gimmick, but it kicked off on Monday. The amount of people I have heard telling me that they were going out for lunch or going out for dinner. We've been back at...
Or breakfast back at, from what I yeah, hear. You can
yeah,
have it
I mean,
though.
Me and Lee were back in the office this week on Monday. And it's all everybody's talking about. Let's go to there. Let's go to there. Where are we going to go? You know, this each day this week. And then back at home, people are saying,
well,
I'm going to go out for dinner.
Where can you go?
One of our local pubs is doing it. You can't book a table.
Wow.
You can look it up on just Google Eat Out to Help Out and go to the gov.uk link, right? And then as you scroll down past the explanation, you can put in your postcode and you can find where you can go local to you. And there are quite a lot of places actually that are doing it, mm-hmm. Some of them being very generous. Dishoom is not limiting the 50% off to £10, so the money it can get back from the government. It is giving 50% off full stop, whatever the size of your bill.
Nice.
Smart move, I think. They're definitely going to get people to spend more money.
We're talking about it as well.
Yeah, but it's, you know, again, this people going out and spending some money eating out is a positive sign. Now, there is the obvious contrast with these concerns of a second wave. And there is the obvious paradox at the moment of the government repeatedly warning people about second waves at the same time as repeatedly telling them to go back to the office, go out to lunch, go out to dinner, go down the shops, and all these other things. And I think people are considering the messages to be exceptionally mixed at the moment. But you know, the economy is doing a bit better than people thought. That's why the Bank of England has revised its awful, awful prediction to just awful. But if we do want to bounce back and get back to anywhere near normal and not to have a really, really long-lasting hangover from this, what we need to have is not the second wave and another lockdown, but also we need people to be going out there and being economically active. Now, some of these things you might frown upon, buying houses that are too expensive, buying new cars when you don't need a new car, going out to dinner just because there's some gimmick from the Chancellor that gives you some money off, like a fancy Pizza Express voucher. But it's all helping the economy. It's all putting money in businesses' pockets.
Exactly.
And that's the kind of thing that staves off job losses and everything like that.
And you spoke about gold being sentiment, but so much of this is about confidence to go back and what Ian Duncan Smith, the former Tory party leader, has been saying. And it's all in relation to the fact that research showing that we are way behind our counterparts across Europe, where in places like France, 83% of people are back in the office. Here it's around 34%. And before I came out here a few weeks ago, I mean, I don't know how much has changed, but there was no one on the tube going into work. And the government, Boris Johnson's changed his message. Don't stay in, go back to work. And if we don't, Ian Duncan Smith says we face economic Armageddon hitting Britain. We must change the message on going back to work. But, well, the reality is a lot of people won't have a job to go back to. A lot of people are still on furlough as well, but some people will be and have been made redundant. So thankfully, Money Mail and This Is Money are doing a series to help. There's loads of information on that. So please do, if you are in that position, take a look. Some are going through some of the tips shortly. But firstly, why such discrepancy in these stats, Simon? Why 34% next to France's 83%?
Well, I would argue that it's probably because France, when it came out of lockdown much earlier, and eased its restrictions considerably earlier. We went into lockdown later, but people in Britain have been sat here watching European countries open up, and we were still within severe lockdown. There are still limits on how many people you can have come round to your house. There are limits on how many people you can have sit in your garden. There are limits on what you can do. Yet people are being told to go back to the office. And understandably, when people are told that, they're like, well, to be honest, actually, I'm doing more work from home. I'm working what would have been my commute. So whilst you're still telling me the stuff is bad and warning me about second waves and limiting me on what I can do, what's the point? Also, employers have been reluctant to get people back because they're concerned about their safety. People have had their kids off school for 4 months. They've had to homeschool them. And the one time when it is actually useful to be at home all the time is the school holidays, particularly as good luck getting any childcare this school holidays. And then also factor in the fact that commuting in this country is unbelievably expensive compared to the cost of commuting somewhere like France, Germany, Italy, Spain. And also, I would argue that people tend to probably live further away from their work, particularly in London. People who are working in London, they suffer longer commutes and things like that. And you have the very potent cocktail for less people going back into the office. And to an extent, I can understand that. You know, I've been back in the office. It's been nice to see people. But you've got to be very socially distanced. And,
yeah.
And you know, it's very difficult, you know, to work out a plan to get everybody back in. You know, that's what everybody's trying to do at the moment. How do we get most people back in? But I can understand it. And I sometimes think that people like Ian Duncan Smith sound a bit tone deaf because, you know, let's face it, Ian Duncan Smith does not have the same experience of going into his office that your everyday grunt in the UK does. Ian Duncan Smith doesn't haul himself in on the train and then the tube and then sat there at a desk packed in next to someone else, does he? I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I'm casting aspersions.
I saw Michael Gove once on the tube.
But you know, we're talking about a world of MPs with second homes close to their work in Westminster and private offices and chauffeur-driven cars and things like that.
But does he not have a little bit of a point, though?
No, he does. He does. But then also,
lives could be lost if we don't sort this out. That was his point.
And then people get annoyed because, you know, I heard a Tory MP the other day talking about, well, because Pret-a-Manger is in trouble.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, excuse me if I weep a tear for companies like Pret-a-Manger and Starbucks. You know, so, you know, I'll spend 400 quid a month getting the train into work so Pret doesn't go bust, is what people are thinking. But Pret-a-Manger employs a lot of people. Starbucks employs a lot of people. All those places do employ a lot of people. But I do think there is an element of chickens coming home to roost here with the fact that our high streets and cities are dominated by large chain companies, some of whom have very, very dubious records of paying amounts of tax that people may think that they should be paying, considering the amount of business they seem to do in this country. So when all of a sudden people start getting the message that they need to go back and help these companies, they think, well, do I? Because actually, when I'm at home, I go down to my local high street, which has got a few more independent businesses on it, and I spend my money there. I tell you who I do really feel sorry for is all of the independent cafes, businesses, restaurants, and places like that that are in the centre of London. Because there are lots of places, you know, in the city, in Soho, in the West End and stuff like that, where there are lots of genuine small independent businesses. It is not entirely the big corporates. And those are the people I feel sorry for. Those are the people that need our money, kind of thing. So I don't know, you know, I can't even remember what your actual question was there before I got riled.
Just talking about
before I presented the opposite argument to the Ian Duncan Smith argument.
I was enjoying the it was all relevant, Simon. It was all relevant.
But I just I do think that it's worth
privilege of others.
Yeah, I think it's worth considering the flip side to this, and I think what people are thinking. You know, there's lots of people thinking there that not going on into the office is A, saving them a small fortune, and B, considerably more convenient. And C, they actually think they're probably doing more work than they were. Yeah. But you do miss that interactivity, the creativity, the bit where ultimately a successful work is built from that kind of network effect of bringing people together and, you know, creating something that is greater than the sum of its parts. And people actually seeing people and spending time with people, you know,
cannot be substituted
by Zoom meetings.
I agree. But I also think, I mean, that can be done perhaps one day a week, and if you can work the rest of the time, then fair. And maybe that's what offices are doing and have to do because to be coronavirus secure or COVID secure. If I was a business and I was a little bit unsure whether I was absolutely 100% COVID secure and my staff could still work from home, I certainly know which option I would take. I wouldn't want to visit from the health and safety executive coming around and suing me at this time for not doing the right thing.
Which is where I think the government and the high-profile critics, the Ian Duncan Smiths of this world, are missing a trick. Instead of saying, go back to the office, I want you to all go back to the office, and then we're just going to leave it to employers as to how they sort it out. Why not come out and say, look, we know you've got concerns. We know you're saving money by not going back there. We know you probably think you're working harder at home, and actually you've worked really hard at home. You've adapted. You've been asked to do something completely out of the ordinary, and you've all adapted and you've all done really well. Could you try to go back 2 or 3 days? Just start with that kind of thing. That's the message they need to be giving, rather than this kind of blood and guts, all or nothing kind of thing that's coming out of some elements of mainly the Tory MPs. I think that would be a more successful message to put across to people. Also, Lee wrote about this week, train fares. If you were commuting in 5 days a week, you used to have a season ticket. You probably used to have an annual season ticket. That made a extremely expensive train fare a little bit less expensive. It was still very expensive. It still cost you perhaps £400 a month, £300, £400 a month, which is a huge amount of money to be spending out of post-tax wages just to get to work. Now, if your employer says to you, we'd like you to come back in 2 or 3 days, you could end up, because you don't benefit from the same annual season ticket element, because you don't need it all those days, even just buying those 2 or 3 days worth of train tickets, you could be spending as much money as you were on that annual season ticket. So, you know, the train companies need to have the strong arm put on them
to
deliver some kind of like 3 day a week season tickets that give you a similar discount to the ones that were 5, because people aren't, it's not because people are choosing to come in less, it's because they're having to come in less, so businesses can try and get more people into the office. And in all honesty, you know, yeah, it's going to cost the train companies money, it's going to cost the government money, but we've spent so much money and we've lost so much money that maybe we just need to speculate to accumulate on this one.
Try and think
of all those pinch points why people don't want to come in, and then tackle them individually one by one.
Absolutely. And it sort of turns that on its head, whereas in the past, the emphasis has been on passengers to pay for it. They've been so reluctant to get taxpayers. I think maybe now is the time to reverse that. But I do want to ask, because you've got a series at the moment, which I think is really important on your website, for anybody who hasn't sadly got a job to go back to at the moment, or is facing redundancy. And, you know, even if you think you're relatively secure in your job, just reading some of the news reports must be incredibly frightening at the moment. You know, family and bills to pay for. So just what are some of the things that people need to remember in terms of redundancy? You know, we've still got very strong employment rights in this country and they've not changed because of coronavirus. And you've got a load of tips on getting back to work. And I guess one of those is, you know, is you might have to be patient at this time as well. But, you know, what are your favourites? Some of the things that think people need to think about. Reassure us, Simon.
Okay, so redundancy-wise, I mean, the first thing that most people will think is, what will I be paid? So what is the redundancy payment that you would get? If your company wants to put, potentially make people redundant, it has to put people on notice. What you want to find out is what that process, how that process is going to operate. But also people want to know about the financial side of it. So what will you be paid? There are rules about this. If you've been working for your current employer for 2 years or more, if you're under 22, you get half a week's pay for each full year you've worked. If you're 22 to 40, you get 1 week's pay. And if you're age 41 or earlier, you get 1.5 weeks pay. The payout's capped at 20 years and a maximum of £538 per week. And the first £30,000 is tax-free. That doesn't sound very generous. A lot of companies will be more generous than statutory redundancy.
Yeah.
If you've been on furlough or maternity leave, your redundancy pay should be calculated based on your full wage.
The government made that law last week.
Companies so really, try to period. Pull a fast
they
one.
They have
this
been
one
during
sometimes.
This period. They have been during. Yeah, was the, it? They shouldn't
they
have done in the past.
But no.
Exactly.
And get it in writing. Okay, you want this in writing. You want it detailed and what the calculate, how it has been calculated from your employer.
Yeah.
Don't just have them say, oh, well, we've told you over the phone. You don't want that. You want it in writing, okay? Because you need to be able to sit down and understand it and you need to interrogate it. There is standard notice. 1 week if you've been employed between 1 month and 2 years. 1 week for each year employed between 2 and 12 years. 12 weeks if you've been in employment for 12 years or more. You'll also have a notice period. So your employer does need to stand up on that. How to challenge it. If the employer is making fewer than 20 redundancies, there's no rules about how they should carry out consultation. Between 20 and 99, consultation must start at least 30 days before dismissals. And if there's 100 job cuts or more, it must be 45 days. And discussions must cover ways to avoid layoffs. Can you do something else within the business and everything like that? Was it fair? If you get an offer of a new role, suitable employment elsewhere, you need to think about it. If you turn it down and it genuinely is a similar role that is suitable for you, you might lose the chance to get the redundancy pay. Again, this is a negotiating thing with your employer. And if you need to look for a new job, your employer can give you time off and should give you time off to look for a new job.
The point to remember is, yeah, absolutely, is that you will get redundancy pay, you'll get notice pay, you should get consultation period, you should basically get all the things that you had before. And if you don't think it's a fair process, there are places that you can go to complain about it. And the idea of redundancy is that your role is no longer available. So if someone else gets shifted into your role, if you've been made redundant, well, that's not the point. It's the job that gets made redundant, not you. It is stressful. And you know, I can imagine a lot of people thinking the last thing they want is to take their company to an employment tribunal if they're not doing the fair thing. But I'd urge employers to do the right thing here. I sound like the government, don't I? Just a couple of really brief tips on what you should be doing if you have just been made redundant. You know, stay positive,
okay.
Network, you know, those sorts of things, right?
Yeah.
Check your LinkedIn, your CV, all the like.
If you're lucky enough to have one, and most people will do, you'll know other people who do similar jobs to you or people who work for other companies. Doesn't matter what you do, whether you work in an office, whether you work in a factory, whether you are in manufacturing, whether you're in retail, you'll know other people. You'll have friends, you'll have family, you'll have colleagues. You will have people that you know in other companies. So think about all those people and work your network. This is a classic one for people who go self-employed. Lots of people who go self-employed and start doing something similar to what they did before manage to pick up work through the people that they already know. Employment agencies, register with the ones that are active in your field and also the big ones, the generalists and so on. Look for where are sectors that are hiring, for example. Obviously, travel has been absolutely hammered and retail, but there are some places that, you know, need more people. Maybe you don't want to do it, but, you know, money's money, or maybe you could pivot into doing this. care work, nursing, customer service, cleaning, administration, childcare, delivery, driving, transport. They all need more people at the moment. Get yourself on LinkedIn, get your CV sorted, make it sound good. Don't make it too crazy. Don't do, if you don't think you're doing anything that's a little bit quirky, stop it. you know, ask for help as well. You know, wherever you can, and ask your employer for help. You know, what can they do to help you try and find a new job? Consider taking a part-time role or even a temporary role. Consider things like maternity cover and stuff like that. You never know what it can lead to. And, you know, stay calm and, you know, just keep plugging away and try to stay positive. Yeah.
Indeed. Right. Finally, Simon, you spoke about Tesla a little bit earlier on. Apparently in lockdown, more of us are keen to buy an electric car. That's what the readers of What Car have been saying to them anyway. So the magazine, which is also online, has compiled a new set of motoring awards naming the best pure electric and plug-in hybrid cars on the market right now. And the good news is it's for all budgets. And this is in order to help us all out if we do want to go electric post-lockdown. Is there a thing about electric post-lockdown, or is this just a general theme anyway? Or is this just people answering a research thing and saying, yeah, in theory, I'd quite like one, but actually I'm not going to buy one.
Well, I think people are just becoming more likely to buy electric cars because electric cars are the future, and people are being pushed to buy electric cars. Electric, you know, pure electric and hybrid. Also, there are more of them available now. The price gap between them and petrol or diesel cars, it still exists, but it is narrowing. And they're getting better, and people are seeing them and thinking, well, do you know what? And they're hearing more about it from people, or maybe friends who've got them, talking about the lower running costs, and the fact that they drive just like a normal car. The vast majority of cars, modern day cars, are actively made so that you can't hear what's going on with the engine. Mm-hmm. And really, that's the main difference between driving an electric car and a normal car, is you can't hear the engine. And actually, quite a lot of them they accelerate quicker. They go a bit faster. The top speed will be lower, but nobody does the top speed in their car. Not in this country, you're not allowed to legally. You'd have to do it on a track. So, you know, you might as well consider it if you're thinking of a new car. And some of the best out there, the best value one, you've got the Seat.
What are the winners? Come on.
Okay, the best value one is the Seat Mi. That is £19,800. It's a little city runaround, relatively affordable.
Still not cheap, is it?
No, because it's pretty much twice the price of a Seat Mi with a 3-cylinder petrol engine. Best small electric car. This is the one that's going to probably do very well. The Peugeot E208. And again, that's £27,000. That's quite a lot of money for a small car. Best family electric car. The Hyundai Ioniq, £29,951. All of this is including the £3,000 plug-in grant, by the way. Best family electric SUV, the Kia e-Niro. That's £33,000. And then you start moving into premium territory and busting out of the opportunity to get that plug-in grant. Best luxury electric SUV, Britain's own Jaguar with its I-Pace. That is a £63,000 car. Great cars, but they do cost £63,000. Mm. The Tesla Model 3, this is Tesla's everyman car. This is the 3 Series rival. But the best executive electric car is its performance version of that. And that cost £56,500. I've driven one of those, and it was an exceptionally good car.
The best Simon's seal of approval.
Yeah, it's an exceptionally expensive. It is an expensive car as well. Best performance electric car, a Porsche Taycan 4S. That's £84,000. This is Porsche's. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, it is a cracking car, though, the Porsche. It really has managed to deliver with the Taycan, but it's a lot of money. And then you've got Tesla's Model X, best electric 7-seater. That starts at £86,000. And you could spend a lot more than £86,000 on it once you get handy on the options list or start going up the power range, not the engine sizes, as I nearly mistakenly said.
One day, Simon, one day we'll be billionaires and we can spend that.
If I could have any one of these, I'd have either the Porsche Taycan or the Jaguar I-Pace.
All right.
Depending on how practical I was feeling.
When I'm rich, Simon, when I'm rich, I'll buy you one. Mm. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, or you'd like to buy Simon that car, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, particularly if you want to buy me one of those cars. You can tweet us at thisismoney and tell me why you don't want to buy me one of those cars. Or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in debate and read the comments.
Error. Why would someone not want to? And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. The This Is Money podcast is brought to you with Charles Stanley Direct. Open an account today and start saving for your future. Investment involves risk.